Over the past few years, different business sectors have faced the digital revolution in very different ways. The music business has been virtually destroyed by it because it allowed itself and still allows itself to be dictated by greed at every decision. Hollywood has embraced it and has tried to adjust to new profit centers and new business models. The book publishing business, perhaps having learned from the mistakes of the music business, has tried to get out ahead of the change and tried to make e-books their own, and in so doing, created some new and inventive opportunities. Perhaps no business has approached digital with less intelligence, less vision, and less strategic thinking than journalism. Arguably a business that could have been at the cutting edge has operated out of fear, ignorance, and petulance. The results have been that once great beacons of journalism, like the Chicago Tribune and the Los Angeles Times, have been decimated. To fully understand all of this, perhaps the penultimate story is the story of what happened to the Chicago Tribune and the Los Angeles Times. We're going to talk about this story today with my guest, award-winning journalist James O'Shea. He's a former managing editor of the Chicago Tribune, a past editor-in-chief of the Los Angeles Times, and he's currently the founder and editor of the Chicago News Cooperative. It is my pleasure to welcome James O'Shea here to talk about his new book, The Deal from Hell, How Moguls and Wall Street Plundered Great American Newspapers. James O'Shea, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
Great to have you here. In many ways, this is the story of the lack of vision of the newspaper business, of journalism. And the sad part of the story, as you point out, is it didn't have to be this way. There were people even as far back as 1989 that saw this coming.
Yes, that's true. I mean, I think when you go back, and I start my book in 1999, at the newspaper, the American Newspaper Association meeting in San Diego. And at that time, people were getting up on the floor warning newspaper executives that, you know, they could get out of step with the economy and the technological innovations that were sweeping through the business. And yet, you know, they did nothing. And they basically looked at the Internet as something that would jeopardize their existing businesses, much in the same way that the automobile companies back in the 70s and the 80s looked at the Toyota Motor Corporations of the world and said, you know, we're going to stick with what we got. The kind of brakes we put on our cars are best because they had a lot of invested in it. So it's a eerie kind of a problem.
And there's a memo that you talk about that circulated, I think it was back in 89 at the Tribune, by a guy, I think, named Jim Squires, who talked about less reliance on advertising, more investment in content, all of the things that might have made it different.
Yes, that's true. Jim Squires wanted to move away from the existing system in which newspaper revenues, about 80%, 90% sometimes, are advertising revenues. And he wanted to move away from that, diversify the revenue stream, quit relying so heavily on circulation statistics that in many cases were bogus anyway, and start diversifying the revenue stream and move into investing in content. And he was treated almost like a heretic. And was eventually forced to resign at the Tribune Company. And his report, which was called, I think, Project Prosperity, sort of lingered in the dust.
You use the auto companies as kind of an analogy. You know, in many ways, their mistakes came out of a deep-seated arrogance. Was it the same in journalism and the newspaper business, or was there also kind of a self-loathing that was going on?
There is a sort of arrogance, you know, and it's as I said in my preface, you know, this really wasn't a book I wanted to write because a lot of these people are friends of mine. But, you know, two things happened that kind of changed my mind. One, a friend whom I know called me and said, you know, you should really write this story. And the reason you should write this story is it's so rare for an insider at your level to actually be able to tell this story, and I wouldn't sign one of the non-disparagement agreements that were designed to kind of keep me quiet, and most people do. And then secondly, I thought, you know, if I could tell the story of how we got into this and report that story, then maybe, just maybe, we can figure a way out of it. So that's why I did it. And I talked about a lot of people, a lot of arrogance, and I mean, we didn't think, and I'm including journalists in this, we just basically felt like we knew better. And I think that's a form of arrogance.
One of the things that happened in all of this is that a lot of it was kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy at various stages. The whole story about the collapse of the LA Times and the Chicago Tribune after Sam Zell took over, all of that was baked into the original deal when the LA Times and the Chicago Tribune came together. And in fact, in many ways, that happened and the families bailed because of conventional wisdom was at the time about the future of journalism.
Right. You know, I call the actually Sam Zell is the one who called the deal. He did the deal from hell. And, you know, I kind of feel like the Tribune Company went to purgatory first when they bought Times Mirror. And that the seeds of the destruction were in that merger. It was working. Certain elements did start to work. But once the economy turned against it, it went down quickly.
Why did that kind of consolidation fail so miserably with respect to the newspaper business? I mean, we saw that consolidation take place in numerous other businesses, including the radio business, where it certainly had devastating effects on the product, but from an economic perspective, they managed to muddle through. Why was it so economically devastating for newspapers?
Well, you know, at first it wasn't. I mean, the Tribune Company made a lot of money from 2000 until about 2004 and 2005. But because they continued this reliance on advertising revenue, and it was so heavy, that when the Internet, the really blooming of the Internet in early 2000 and after the initial bust, it's just simply, you know, better and easier to advertise on the Internet. And so a lot of revenue left, and then you had the advent of Craigslist coming along, and you know, about half of the industry's revenue was tied up in classified advertising revenue, and suddenly people could go on Craigslist and put an ad on for free. So you had this huge company heavily reliant on ad revenue. I think at the Los Angeles Times, for instance, 80-85% of your revenue came from advertising, and the 15% or so was circulation revenue. So when the ad revenue really starts going away, and going away rapidly, the company couldn't increase the price of the LA Times. It couldn't double the price because it had conditioned people to receiving the information at a low cost. And then you had the papers going on online and giving away the content for free. So, I mean, I think they had few choices. Because of that heavy reliance on ad revenue, and that ad revenue was tied to their circulation numbers. So, you know, you had that really terrible combination. And so I think, unlike a lot of other businesses, it just collapsed. And then secondly, one thing that I learned from being the editor of the LA Times and having spent a lot of my career in Chicago with the Tribune Company, I came away from my experience at the LA Times thinking newspapers should be owned locally. They should not be owned by some big corporation in Chicago or New York or wherever, or even Los Angeles. They should be owned by people in the community because they're really a part of the community, and they should remain a part of the community. And the community should make it's kind of the community's face, and it should be able to have a voice in that. And so I think that was another aspect of it, of trying to get so much profit out of them. You built the incentive to keep the advertising revenue. You built the incentive for the status quo, and the status quo was not going to be good enough.
And, of course, part of the problem is that when these papers came together, when the Tribune bought, essentially, the L.A. Times, there was $8 billion at play, much of that in debt that had to be serviced.
Yes, but they actually paid down some of that. They sold off some assets. They were generating profit margins of 20 and 25%. So, you know, they were paying that debt down. It was the debt that Sam Zell piled on it when he took it over that really sunk it. And because they had paid off, I can't remember, but of that $8 billion, they had paid off quite a bit of that. And so they still had it on their books, but it wasn't onerous. But when Zell came along, he piled on top of that another $13 billion. And so that the debt was very, very heavy. And by the way, Sam Zell, who was a real estate investor, who really, he believed that he was going to make a lot of money. He thought all of those assets were worth about $17 billion, and he was getting them for $13 billion, and most of that was borrowed money, somebody else's money. So he thought he was going to make a killing. He was wrong.
Talk about why there was the need for Sam Zell in the first place. Why there was the need for somebody to come along and buy this entity.
Well, that kind of relate goes right back to the mm-hmm. Chandler family in Los Angeles. And what happened was as the Tribune Company started experiencing trouble, and its cash flow began drying up, it began cutting back and laying off people and killing off sections. The Chandler family was worried that it wouldn't be able to maintain the kind of dividends or the kind of growth that they could. So they basically put the company up for play by writing this letter that was a blistering critique of the existing management of the Tribune, and that in effect was put it up for sale. 14, 15 big companies from all across the nation came out to take a look, but in the end, the only bidder was Sam Zell, because everybody else looked at the revenue trends and they looked at what was happening in the media and they saw what was happening with the internet, and they didn't want to get into that business. And now, there were a few people who looked at it. Eli Broad and looked at it. David Geffen looked at it. There were a few people like that out of Los Angeles that looked at buying the Tribune Company or buying the LA Times. The Chandlers even considered repurchasing the LA Times. But in the end, no one would pay as much as Sam Zell, which was $34 a share, and so he got the company.
And this is where it comes back to this idea of a self-fulfilling prophecy, because journalism and the newspaper business had such a bad rap at that point, nobody really wanted to take the chance.
No, you know, it's funny because the newspaper business was getting a bad rap because its circulation was declining, and what was really happening is there was a circulation scandal at Newsday, which was owned by Tribune Company, right, about fake circulation practices. And it turns out that a lot of newspapers were playing games with the numbers. And a lot of times in Newsday in Long Island, it attracted the interest of the U.S. attorney who was prosecuting people for this. And so everybody was watching Newsday to see what was happening. More typical was, you know, they were just pushing the limits of the Audit Bureau of Circulation Rules, which is kind of the newspaper industry's self-appointed watchdog. And they were just pushing the limits, but those numbers were squishy. And as they saw the U.S. attorney in Brooklyn prosecuting, they began thinking, we better get rid of some of this circulation. Advertisers said, we're no longer going to pay for that. So what was a bad situation of newspapers' revenues, circulations going down 2 and 3%, suddenly looked a lot worse because they were dropping 5 to 6%. And so you had a really bad situation. You had a bad situation made worse because they were trying to correct some of their past problems.
The other thing that was going on at the same time was a loss of focus on the product itself. And that was really a function, one, of the financial pressures, and two, of the individuals, the personalities involved. People like John Madigan, who you talk about at the Tribune, and Mark Willis at the LA Times.
Well, what was happening, nobody really knew what to do. I mean, that was the problem. And so what they would do, the only way you could cope with declining revenues in many instances was cut. So, so you could maintain those margins that Wall Street had gotten used to. So what was happening is, as they would look at the paper, they'd say, okay, what can we stop doing? What can we no longer do? So you start taking away. I remember when I was editor of the LA Times, we stopped running the TV book. Now, the truth is, that wasn't the best way to get information about what was on television, was a print book. It was hard to read. As we cut back on newsprint, it got smaller and the type was harder to read. But there was still something there. So it was trying to kind of keep something in the newspaper, but that probably should have been killed off. We did kill off that section. We lost quite a few readers, but we were trying to come back with a different way of coverage, a different method of coverage that would have made it better. And we were just too late with a lot of those things.
To what extent did it have an impact that both of these individuals that I mentioned really did not come from the newspaper business per se?
Yeah, I it's true. I think that in the early days of the newspaper business, when a lot of the families owned them, and there were people in these families that were no angels either, but they really did believe, they really saw themselves as part of the community. They saw themselves as part of the civic structure. And so their view was they ran a public service business. And if you served the public, you would have readers. And if you would have readers, you would have advertisers. And if you have advertisers and readers, you would have circulation and advertising revenue. And they also had an obligation, a fiduciary duty, to their owners. And I think what happened when John Madigan came from an investment banking background. Mark Willis was a business, he was a businessman. He came from General Mills. And when they came in, they began looking and saying, well, wait a minute, now we have two duties here. We have a public responsibility and we have a fiduciary duty. And I think things got flipped around and the public duty was subordinated to the fiduciary duty because they believed if you don't make a profit and you don't make a lot of money, you won't have a newspaper. If you don't have a newspaper, you won't have news. And so I think it really is a kind of they upended this long-standing commitment to public service first and profit second, and made it profit first and public service second.
But the thing that seemed to be missing was any kind of vision, any kind of sense of really what the business was about. I mean, you could make the case that newspapers, at least, by the time we were getting to the mid-2000s, it was arguably an inefficient way to deliver information. But there were really no visionaries saying, this is what's important, this is the way we can do it now. It was really just trying to make the old model more economically efficient.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. What we needed was someone who could see this larger event, larger force moving through the Internet, and how can I change this company to fit in with that and take advantage of it? And what we ended up doing was we didn't know how to do that. We viewed it really as more of a threat or as something that we could just try to deal with and cope with. And I think the Tribune Company, were really good executors. They could take a given conventional policy and execute it well. They could go into a printing plant and take one of their people and say, go in there and make this the most efficiently run printing plant in the world. And they could do that. But when it came to the vision, there wasn't a lot of that. And the pressure was very intense on everyone to keep producing these profits because, the Tribune Company at one point was like the darling of Wall Street and media companies. It would routinely turn in 20 and 25% margins. And so everybody, was under the gun to continue those kind of margins. And the only way you were going to be able to continue when your revenue started stagnating was through cost cutting. And when you started cutting costs, you'd lose readership. And you kind of got into this cycle of decline, which, frankly, I think is still going on.
Although the only thing that is different now is that you do see some group. I mean, the New York Times is trying to do it in a lot of experimentation. The Atlantic Group is trying to do it, really trying to find some new models to deliver good journalism and make it economically viable.
Yes, and I think both of those cases, the New York Times and the Atlantic, it was born out of desperation. When you're desperate, people will take those risks. And when people thought that they could maintain a comfortable margin, they didn't want to take those risks. And so bad times sometimes breeds good developments. And I think that's the case with the Atlantic does a really good job. The New York Times is experimenting. I'm involved with them in an experiment here in Chicago where they help. They partner with me, and I provide Chicago news two times a week in their Friday and Sunday paper. And they had never done that before prior to me, but they decided that they would take a chance on us. And so we're a 501c3 nonprofit news organization that's really mostly dependent on charitable contributions. But right now we're trying to get enough money so we can experiment with pay models so that we can become self-sustaining on our own within a couple, few more years. And those kinds of efforts popping up around the country will probably, hopefully, we'll discover how we can finance serious public service journalism, because that's really what's needed, is how are you going to finance this kind of journalism in the future, because it's vitally needed more than ever today.
Going back to your story and the deal from hell, talk a little bit about Sam Zell and what happened when he put up his $13 billion and took over.
Well, when Sam Zell first came along, you know, we had gone through several years of cutbacks and buyouts and killing off sections. And so everybody was getting pretty weary of it. At the LA Times, when I got there, I was the third editor in 2 years. Everybody was weary. And so here comes along somebody who's a billionaire. He had just sold his equity office properties, which was a commercial real estate operation, for $39 billion. And so everybody thought, wow, well, maybe he can figure this out. Maybe he's our messiah, you know. Maybe he's the one that will pave the way and figure out how we can do this. So he was kind of a rock star, and everybody was really hopeful. And Sam came in. He's sort of a smallish guy. He always wears jeans and an open collar shirt. He's the total opposite of the kind of button-down people that ran Tribune Company. And Sam comes along saying, you know, you can't cut your way out of this. You know, you're going to have to figure out how to grow. And, you know, that's music to everybody's ears, particularly the journalist. And so we're all sitting there thinking, okay, well, maybe this guy will help us. And that turned out to be wrong. Sam came in, and once he got control, he went on one of his tours around the company and disparaging journalists, disparaging journalism. He was kind of a crude guy who used rough language and was just not the sort of person that everybody thought he was going to be.
And, of course, some of the people that he brought in with him to run it simply exacerbated all of that.
Yeah, I mean, his executive team was led by a guy, Randy Michaels, and Randy was... did not, he came in and his old idea was blow this place up. He thought that the culture needed to be changed, and you know, there was some truth to that. There was a need for a change in the culture, but his idea was to just completely blow the place up, and he wrote a memo on what to do in the first 100 days, and it was like a 13-page single-space memo. It never used the word journalism. And it basically talked about, you know, forget it, this stuff about giving the people what they need. We're going to give them what they'll read and what they want. And this is an attention deficit disorder society. And it was just a disaster.
What impact did that have on the people that worked there? What impact did it have on the product?
Well, the people that worked there, right after he took over, there were some fairly substantial layoffs. Both the LA Times and the Chicago Tribune and all across the country at Tribune Papers, I think the Baltimore Sun at one point in one single layoff got rid of a third of its newsroom. And so it created a lot of unemployed journalists. The products itself, the newspapers themselves, the impact varied. All of the papers cut back on space devoted to news, and all of them killed off sections. In Los Angeles, I don't think the impact was as bad as it was in Chicago. In Chicago, they took a dramatically different turn in terms of the content of the paper, and they went from they followed the Randy Michaels model, which was to create a more sensationalized, more trivial paper. I don't think that worked, and I think they've lost a lot of readers. So, and every product, every newspaper had a different kind of, you know, impact. The policies had a different impact on each newspaper, but generally it created unemployed journalists and lower quality newspapers.
And, of course, the deal itself blew up and is now in the bankruptcy courts, where it has been for some time and probably where it will stay for a little while.
Yes, the judge, there are two competing plans, one by the original bankers, J.P. Morgan Chase, and the big banks that lent a lot of the money are floated the deals. And then there's another group of creditors led by some funds who had purchased some of this debt. And they have a competing plan, and the judge is trying to figure out which of those two plans he is going to approve. They had a hearing on that just the other day. There is some speculation that the judge may ask them to resolve whether or not there was fraud involved in the transaction itself. He had appointed an examiner to look at that allegation, which had been originally leveled by one of the creditors. And the examiner came back and said, if this would go to trial, it's likely that a jury could conclude that there was fraud in this transaction. And so if that has to be litigated and settled before the bankruptcy judge picks a plan, they're going to be in bankruptcy for quite a while. If they could get a plan approved, and they could exit bankruptcy, but then they would be owned by banks who don't want to be in the newspaper business, and I'm afraid that you would see more cuts.
And, of course, one of the stories you tell is the financial part of this story when Zelle was taking it over, and simply bankers on Wall Street being as bankers on Wall Street are. They were only interested in the deal, only interested in the fees.
Well, once you have $13 billion in debt laying out there, that's going to generate a lot of income for the investment bankers who basically make the loans and then sell them off to others in the secondary financial markets. So in this case, the banks in the first, this was a two-phase deal, and a half of it closed in May of 2007, and half of it closed in the year-end 2007. In the first half of the deal, the banks made $161 million in fees and expenses. In the second phase, it was $122 million. So that's $280 million in fees and expenses. I mean, that would have been enough for me to run the Los Angeles Times with more than 900 journalists for 2 years. With those kind of incentives and the way the markets were working of lending the money, creating a security and then selling it off to somebody else and keeping the fees, there's this huge incentive to do deals like this. And the only thing that really stopped it is when the banks couldn't make the loan and then sell it off to somebody else. If they had to keep it, they'd have to mark it down as the fortunes of the company fell, and that's really what happened.
Through the lens of this story, of what happened to these great newspapers, through this lens, what do you see as the future of serious journalism in the country?
Well, I think you will have serious journalism. One fear I have is that, the people willing to pay $2 a day for the New York Times or $6 on Sunday, are people willing to pay $18,000 to $20,000 to get a machine from Bloomberg installed in their office or home, will have all the high-quality news they want, probably as good or better than we get today. But the rest of the people who don't want to pay that, who can't afford that, are going to be left with a news that is not as good by far. My fear is that, as the advertising continues to shrink, and it will in newspapers, that newspapers will continue to lay off journalists. Then they will begin basically, they'll need content to service the advertising, the declining advertising they have, and they'll just start printing press releases and other things like that and calling it news. And so people will be getting their news out of City Hall brought to them by City Hall. And the wealthy people will be getting really good news by the New York Times and other organizations like that. So that's why I decided to start what I've started, is to try to figure out a way to be able to finance this. Because, the collecting and gathering of news is not the expensive part of a newspaper. It accounts for usually somewhere between 10 and 15% of your revenue. The rest of it, the other 85%, is physically producing a newspaper and delivering it to someone's doorstep. That's the expensive part of it. So if you can figure out a way to do this online, and you don't have to charge that much. If I could get people here, if I could get 50,000 people in the Chicago area, and that is less than one half of 1% of the population in the metropolitan area, if I could get them to pay me $2 a week, I could hire 40 to 50 journalists to cover the city, and that's what my goal.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's the possibility that serious journalism, someone will figure this out. It may not be me. I don't know. You know, I'm trying out here. But somebody's going to figure it out, make a business out of it, and you'll have some quality news. It's going to be a rough transition, though, because the newspapers cannot continue to deliver these physical newspapers to somebody's door at these prices. They just can't do it. And the advertising that used to subsidize that is going away rapidly, and it's going to continue going away. So the real answer, I think, is probably some smaller organization like mine, or maybe we figure out a good way to do this and we end up pairing up with one of the existing news organizations and figuring out how to create a package of online news and maybe a print newspaper once or twice a week or something like that, and that will make sense economically.
What about the degree to which so much of the information that's out there is aggregated and then put back out there for free?
Well, I think that's going to stop because newspapers can't continue to do this. You know, a lot of newspapers actually right now are charging for online content, but they're smaller newspapers, and and they are not losing readers, and they are getting people that will pay for information online, and they still have print product customers who will pay more to get their paper delivered to their doorstep. But that tends to be in smaller markets, where it's a more localized news. In your major metropolitan dailies, they're still struggling with that. But the source of that news that is aggregated and put out there for free often comes from newspapers.
Right.
You know, there was a study done in Baltimore by a journalistic organization that is committed to excellence in journalism, and they took six kind of stories that were six narrative lines of big stories that were what happened over a 2-week period, and they traced back through those stories to who was the original source, who really reported this story, and who just repeated it. And what they discovered was legacy news organizations such as newspapers or even some cases television stations accounted for about 90% of that news. So basically, everybody else is just taking their stories, repeating them. And so in Baltimore, where they did this study, if you look at the Baltimore Sun, what you will see is that the newspaper is generating almost 80% of this kind of content, yet its staff has been cut more than 50% over the last few years, and it's still declining. So as it becomes harder and harder and harder for newspapers to deliver that content, the aggregators are going to have to get content from somewhere, and that's why I'm a little bit worried about it, because if they decide, okay, I'm going to just take the City Hall's version of events and put it out there, you won't have any independent reported news. You will just have news releases and other sorts of things like that, and I think that could be very damaging.
James O'Shea, his book is The Deal from Hell, How Moguls and Wall Street Plundered Great American Newspapers. Jim, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Well, thank you.